Hello and welcome, dear listeners, to another edition of the Odd Job Pod, where myself, Graham Sibley, and Terry DeFelin, whose voices you will hear very presently, discuss all things James Bond. Now, this is an unusual one because, gentlemen, I'm going to go straight into this because we've, it's been a while since No Time to Die, and we've filled our time by rewatching all the Bond films and talking about the Bond films as we do. But today, Graham, we have news. We have actual news to discuss.
Well, we do.
This hasn't happened in quite a long time in the Bondverse. And yes, have you dusted off your old press hat so you can feel that you are now discussing legitimately news?
Well, yeah, I think so. I've got my long raincoat on, my grubby little notepad, and yes, I'm down on the street getting the news as we speak. Not really. I'm just trawling online and seeing what the confirmed rumours are. Because yeah, we've had rumours for years, haven't we? And we've actually talked about what would be the next step for Bond. And it appears now that there is actually movement in a certain direction. It came last month when news that Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson were finally giving up creative control to Amazon last month. And then just in the last week or so, we've had news of the new hands on the wheel now, who are Amy Pascal and David Heyman, both who have some, if not a lot of experience with the franchise, but certainly with other franchises. And I suppose this is what the whole feeling about where the direction of Bond is going to go. Terry, pick it up.
Yeah, I was going to ask Terry, how do you feel about Bond now ending up in the house of Amazon?
Well, I mean, I don't like Amazon as a company, but I don't know too many who do. I don't like Amazon the company, and yet I'm an Amazon Prime member. So if we're talking about having a conversation about corporate evil, we could go down that road. But there are some realities about this. Amazon own MGM. MGM distribute this film and now have creative control over it. They have been making movies under Amazon's banner for some years now, and they've been making perfectly good, serviceable, practical films by any measure, movies that people watch. So I'm not particularly concerned about the ethics of Amazon owning stuff, because if I got concerned about the ethics of Hollywood, I would never watch any movies. So I just can't. I don't have the capacity. I haven't got the mental and emotional capacity to start getting uptight about things like this. I shop at Amazon. I watch movies on Amazon Prime. I watch TV shows on Amazon Prime. And Amazon are now going to be making, you know, my favorite film franchise. And I'm just going to have to manage that myself, and that's fine. And I have chosen to look forward to it, and I am confident that they will not, at least at the beginning, they will not mess it up, because after all, they're going to be taking a huge punt on this. They're going to be spending a huge amount of money, and they're not going to want to mess it up themselves. So I don't have any kind of broader ethical, moral concerns, or if I do, I've decided to put them to one side.
Yes, there are a lot of, I feel that there's a quote from Reverend Lovejoy that's appropriate here from The Simpsons when he picks up the Bible and go, Marge, if you've ever read this thing, it's actually illegal to go to the toilet, which I feel is very much in keeping with any kind of ethical consideration that you have to make in today's age as a consumer. But Graham, I guess, as Terry said, there is going to be a lot of eyes on this. This isn't just, a long break like we had between Dalton and Pierce Brosnan, but this is a very much a complete reset of everything that the Bond is. We obviously had the ending of No Time to Die. We have a new Bond. We have new producers. We have new owners. And there's going to be a lot of pressure and a lot of people. There's going to be a lot of interest in this. How confident are you that Amazon will be able to get this right when we do eventually see a Bond?
I'm quite confident, actually. I think they know what works and what doesn't work. They've got all the numbers of all the sort of TV shows that they produce, and they produce a lot of TV shows. So they will know what works. They've got some people in there with experience of the franchise, which is good. You're always going to have Bond fans that are going to be outraged by this, already outraged by this, and will be claiming that that's the end of the franchise, that someone's going to ruin it. They're going to do what they've done with Star Wars and Marvel. These are the valid criticisms that are being levelled at this current movement in the franchise. If Bond fans get up in arms by a blonde Bond being cast, they are going to get up in arms about some other new producers on the franchise. Of course, you know, the whole thing about the Broccoli dynasty, Broccoli Wilson dynasty, and going back to Broccoli Saltzman, is that there has been a direct lineage there throughout all of the films. And there is a feeling now that is cut off. But I don't know if it is or not. I still presume they're going to keep the 007 soundstage at Pinewood, still make it through there, still use a lot of the people who are involved in those films, the people who have been involved in films over and over and over again over the years. But then we have to remember that they've only made 5 films in the last... 24 years?
Something like that, isn't it?
Yeah. So, a lot of the talent isn't going to be there because they've retired, basically. So the films have changed a huge amount, even over the space of Craig's films, even over the last space of the last 3 films, they've really changed. So change is coming. Change is coming. Change has to come for the Bond franchise. It always does. And that's how Bond has survived for 60 odd years is through change. And this is just more change. But change it can handle, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It's almost... sorry, Terry, you go.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, I mean, I suppose the significant change about this is that what we've always had is we've had some degree of continuity, in terms of production. We've had the same writers, directors, producers involved, and well, obviously not from 1962 all the way through to 2019, but there's been that overlap and continuation and continuity that has kept the Bond signature, if you like, going on. And there's a possibility of that break happening, of a clean break happening now, which we wouldn't necessarily get. But as Graham points out, this was always going to be kind of on the cards because just the rate with which James Bond films are now being produced, you know, it's harder to maintain that continuity because people are retiring or quitting or going to other things. They're not able to prioritise the James Bond films. Not like back in the good old days in the 70s, 80s, you know, when they were churning out these movies, you know, on a regular basis, and crews knew that they just had to wait for a few months and then they'd be back on the lot doing work again. And that hasn't been the case about James Bond for some years now. There are those of us, specifically me, who would love to see that come back, but I appreciate that that's probably not going to happen. So yeah, I think that this feels like a natural end to the Broccoli era, even though it would appear to have come about with no small amount of acrimony. Rather naively, and I think you share this view, but I will claim that it was a naive view for myself, I thought at the end of No Time to Die that actually this was really Broccoli and Michael G. Barbara and Michael G. Wilson saying goodbye and stepping back. But actually, as it turns out, that wasn't the case at all. They were keen to keep going. And then it turns out they were at loggerheads with Amazon, and this is where we are now. But so if in fact, I think that in my mind, this feels like the right thing to do at this point. It's just the way that it's gone about it is not entirely as I expected it. And it leaves a little bit of a sour taste in the mouth, because I don't think that this is quite the way that Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson might have wanted to have gone. But, you know, this is Hollywood, this is business, this is cinema, and it is a ruthless, ruthless business. And so it is often the case that things go that way. And, you know, I think everyone will end up smiling, because obviously everyone's being well paid, everyone's being compensated. You know, I don't think it's going to be that acrimonious, but I'm sure it's very emotional. And I think Bond fans are entitled to feel emotional. I have a question. The people who are complaining about this changeover, and the people who how many of those people are the same people who complained about Daniel Craig's appointment in the first place, and even complain or don't like the direction that the franchise has gone under Daniel Craig's era. Of course, under Barbara Broccoli's almost direct, Michael G. Wilson, of course. But really, this is Broccoli's, Craig is Broccoli's Bond, Barbara Broccoli's Bond. And these movies, I think more than Michael G. Wilson's, are Barbara Broccoli's Bonds. And a lot of people don't like him. So how many of those people are also now uncertain about the Amazon? For me, as someone who's a bit adjacent to the Craig Bond films, I am at a place at the moment where I prefer a different area of Bond films. I'm quite looking forward to seeing something different.
I think as well, the flip side of that is how many people have come into the franchise with Craig's Bond and worrying about, well, this could be the first time they've seen the change of Bond. And so, I mean, remember that, you know, he's been Bond for 20 years.
Yeah.
So there hasn't been another one for 20 years. So there is a lot of people who have not had a change of Bond in their adult life.
That's wild if you think about it, isn't it, really? And five films to show for it, which is...
There is moments of change. But I think you've got to look at things... I mean, people will say, oh, it's just going to be like the Marvel franchise where they've just got so much stuff coming out, or the Star Wars franchise. But the Star Wars stuff remains true to the Star Wars vision. And the Marvel stuff remains true to the Marvel vision. So I don't think you're going to see a change of direction. I think, if anything, it's perhaps going to be even more conservative in its approach. I think it's less likely to push it in stranger directions. So I would say that the people who are worrying about it, you should be more worried about the lack of creativity rather than over creativity.
That's a very good question, actually, because one thing just before we move and pivot a little bit that I did want to touch on, and Terry, Amazon do have another very big piece of IP sitting within their sitting within their vaults, which is the Tolkien IP. And we have Rings of Power, which was an incredibly expensive piece of TV. And that hasn't exactly been well received. So rather than necessarily the worry about what's going to happen, Terry, should we be worried about the creativity that's coming from there when you are asking a new custodian to take over what is a very kind of well-defined franchise, as indeed the world of Tolkien is as well?
No, I don't think we should be worried. They also got the Wheel of Time as well, which is nowhere near as big an IP as, say, Bond or the Rings of Power, but it is still an IP with a lot of fans and a lot of specific opinions about it too. I'm not worried about. I'm aware that that there are a lot of Tolkien fans and Lord of the Rings fans who are not happy in the slightest. And a lot of them tend to be the kind of sort of like right-wing geek bros that just don't like this kind of stuff anyway, because they just don't like it when characters are changed excessively in their view. As pieces of work, I've watched the first season of Rings of Power, and I thought it, I mean, there was parts of it that made me cringe, but I thought, generally speaking, I thought it was decent. I am not a Tolkien fan by any stretch, but I am familiar with the work. And as always, you know, views are mixed. When you mess about with something like that, then you're always going to get strong opinions. But the thing about the Lord of the Rings saga is ultimately, it goes back to the book, or the three books plus the Silmarillion, the Hobbit, and all of that stuff. And then there's then looks back to the Peter Jackson films, which were prodigious. But we're talking about six movies. Now, Bond has got the heritage of all of the Fleming books and all of the James Bond movies, and its heritage really will probably be to look at those movies and take its cue from there. I don't think that they need, or they're being encouraged, to do anything different about James Bond. No, it's been years since we've seen a Lord of the Rings film. It's reasonable to think a new bunch of creators come along after a long time and go, well, let's just tweak things, change things up a bit. Let's make things. I don't see any need for that to happen with James Bond, and so therefore I'm not altogether certain that that would happen. And also, I think they might have learned some lessons also from the Rings of Power and gone, well, actually, we need to be careful not to change things too much because we might end up upsetting our base. And Graham has made a very good point as well, because and this is something that I think older Bond fans need to bear in mind. Demographic expansion of the Bond fandom is much bigger now than it was before Daniel Craig. Daniel Craig has brought in a lot more, I'm probably going to suggest a lot more female viewers, but also a lot more people from different parts of the world and from different audience groups that wouldn't ordinarily have watched. They would never have watched Roger Moore's James Bond, and they probably wouldn't have watched Pierce Brosnan's James Bond. So we need to be careful not to assume that we're just maybe going to stay, maybe go back to making good old-fashioned James Bond movies where they just like he just does stuff. I think that we're going to see a deeper, more meaningful, more dramatic, more emotional James Bond films. I think that's going to continue. Some Bond films won't like that. They might want to see it go back to when it was perhaps a little bit more light, a little bit more fun. So I don't think that we need to worry about that, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, the producers, let's try and separate Amazon, who are bringing the money, and the producers who are going to make this film. These are the people who have made the Sony Spider-Man films, particularly the most recent animated films, which are excellent by any stretch of the imagination. They're excellent. And while I am not really a Harry Potter guy, those movies are well-liked and loved by many, many fans and have made an absolute shit ton of cash. So I don't think that there's anything to worry about there. I think James Bond is in good hands. That doesn't mean it'll be rubbish. It'll be a good film. It doesn't mean it'll be rubbish. We shall wait and see. There's so many more things to happen. We've not got writers, we've not got a director, and we haven't got a James Bond yet. But I think we can say that this is a sensible approach. Two very experienced producers, both in their 60s, both with a huge amount of experience in handling very, very lucrative, very popular IP. I think it's a good start.
It's going to be interesting. I mean, it's actually quite nice to be talking about something potentially new coming, even though it's going to be a very long way away. But let's just talk about what happens when people who really don't know what they're doing with the James Bond film start getting involved with James Bond. So we have spent in the last week, Graham, Terry and I have all partaken in watching Casino Royale, not the Craig version, but the 1967 spoof version of Casino Royale. And yes, we're starring David Niven, Peter Sellers, and actually a large, very large starry cast. And Graham, it's for those who haven't watched the 1967 Casino Royale, and to be fair, a lot of people may not. It is a curio. It's something which I don't think makes its way to TV very often. It is buried around streaming services. What should somebody do when approaching watching Casino Royale 1967 for the first time?
Well, I don't think people should watch it for the first time. Basically, there is no reason to watch this film. That's what I'll say for on the outset. But we've watched it, so you don't have to, listeners. Now, that's not saying that it is completely valueless. There are things in it that are interesting. There are some things that are funny. There are some things that are actually beautiful, really. But the whole thing is just terrible. It as well, it doesn't work. It was stuck together while it was being shown on its premiere. It was still being edited at the up to the day. One of the main stars walked out, which caused horrific rewrites. New scenes had to be shot, and many of the scenes do not go together. There are five named directors. There may have been more. And if you look at it, if you do watch it, listeners, then you have to look at it as more of an anthology. It's more of a collection of sketches and scenes. That's the best way I can see it. But yeah, if you do want to watch it, then well, you know, fine, be my guest.
Do so at your own risk.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but listen to the soundtrack by all means. It's Burt Bacharach did the soundtrack, and it's mostly gorgeous. That soundtrack has got some lovely. It's a beautiful film. The production designer, I can't remember the guy's name, but it looks amazing. The sets are amazing. The imagination behind the sets are amazing. They're very much of their time. It initially had begun as a sort of much more serious interpretation, and then it was sort of like turned into a comedy. The fact that, you know, it was Peter Sellers who was the main star who left, a guy very much at this point at the peak of his powers, and at maybe not at the peak of his career, but close enough. It's just lavish and gorgeous to look at, but as a movie, as a plot, as a story, it doesn't really seem to make any kind of sense. There's an awful lot of things that are just left completely unsaid, but not in a kind of literary kind of way, but in a kind of, well, yeah, we're going to have to cut that scene because I don't know, because, well, it was never filmed.
Yeah.
You know, it's just become a complete mess of a film. That does have its lovers, and there are people who defend Casino Royale, but I genuinely don't understand why.
Well, I think I can understand that there are some people who are just purely contrarian.
Yes,
that is one way. But there is one thing about Casino Royale. The only reason Casino Royale is still remembered is because it is loosely associated with the James Bond franchise.
Hmm.
If it wasn't, it would be like any other number of screwball comedies from the mid-1960s that will just be consigned to the bin, that wouldn't even make it onto ITV4. There are so many of these films that just live in this place that would be a quirky thing that only film students would know about. But this film is repeatedly shown for some reason. For many years, I thought the problem was ITV had done a terrible cut on it. Because, you know, they've got previous.
They did do that.
Yeah.
No, they probably still do, but they were terrible at that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's what I immediately thought was the problem with this film, but it's not. It's just horrifically bad film. Come on, Gary, give us your interpretation of this.
It's a very strange film. It makes very little sense at all. If it had a plot or a storyline or a script, there is potentially something in there. There's hints occasionally of what it could have been. It's not particularly, it has moments of humor, but it's not particularly funny. It's not entirely clear what anybody is trying to do in there. You have Woody Allen doing Woody Allen things at one point. You have Peter Sellers doing Peter Sellers things at one point. You have complete sort of skits and vignettes which don't even make any sense at all within the entire element. Probably what's more, my enjoyment of it, and there were, I will actually say, there are a few bits that I did enjoy, or there are a few bits that I found genuinely curious and interesting from a Bond aficionado. As a film, it's the type of film that I think would have probably been better had I had some sort of mind-altering substance beforehand. if given that I hadn't and was completely sober when I was watching it, this is kind of one of my takeouts. So I'm going to give a, I'll probably chuck out a few here and there. My one takeout, and Terry, be interested to get your thoughts on this. I would have dearly loved to see a Bond film with Orson Welles as the villain in there, because I genuinely enjoyed the scenes with him as Le Chiffre. And just seeing him on screen, he's got a presence, and that I enjoyed a lot. So that was probably my biggest enjoyment. And can you just imagine Orson Welles as a proper Bond villain?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I can, when you think about what's being done on the actual Bond franchise at the time, this is Connery era, you know, and they were living in the era of Donald Pleasance and Gert Frobe, you know, and Adolfo Celli. And Orson Welles, I think, would have been an outstanding, well, any one of those characters. I think he could have played. I suspect the truth of it is that he probably was too expensive. And ironically, and this is where it all gets really silly, is that he was well known for being a man who liked to have control of the projects that he was in. And I would suggest to you that you know, that Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman might have found it somewhat difficult to work with Orson Welles because of the creative control that he might have wanted. I suspect that he wasn't too fussed about this Casino Royale because it was clearly an absolute hot mess of a movie, and I guess he probably just like picked up his paycheck. But it is disappointing that he was the only James Bond film that Orson Welles is in was this one. But at the same time, that would suggest that, you know, who would he have played? Would he have replaced Gert Frobe as Goldfinger? I think he'd have been amazing. But then that would have meant replacing Gert Frobe as Goldfinger, which would have been a different film. So it is it's a lovely thought. Maybe into the 1970s, if he'd been able to play something like that. But I think he's such a big star that he might have dominated the movie. A James Bond film, but perhaps in a way that wouldn't have been entirely welcome. So yeah, I think it's one of those things that you put it down to. I mean, I enjoyed his moments in you know, the small vignette with which, I mean, again, these are little portmanteaus, little bits of the movie, and I thought it was disappointing that we didn't see more of him. But then that just reflects the whole movie. It's just like, just when it starts, looks like it's doing something, they then just like go, well, we have to cut to do something completely different. We're now going to go and do a big thing with Matt Bond and James Bond's daughter, and we're going to have a look at that. And then, well, wait, we've got exploding, you know, milk floats here, and then we've got some kind of hokey Avengers-style car chase with lots and lots of undercranking going on. And it was just all like a total, like, mess and just didn't... It really annoys me.
Well, apparently I've read somewhere that Peter Sellers refused to act with Orson Welles. So all the scenes the scene at the card table where they're together apparently is done with a body double for Peter Sellers, and I think that's because Peter Sellers wrote a lot of his own dialogue,
right?
And I reckon Orson Welles wasn't having that, and
probably true.
And so was probably as intransigent, wanted control over his dialogue as well. And so,
well, he went into his kind of, at one point Sellers is doing his skits, which we would more associate. Some of them would have been from the Goon Show, and of course there's his now infamous sort of like Indian character impression, which of course was hilarious in the 50s and 60s, but is like not remotely funny now. That can't be helped to a certain degree, but the point I think I'm making is, it much like Woody Allen, is that Woody Allen is doing the kind of things that Woody Allen was doing at that time.
Yeah.
And it's like they've gone, well, we kind of don't really know what to do here, guys, so can you just do your spit, your skit, please?
Yeah.
You know, can you just like channel the Goon Show for a minute? Can you do Bananas, please, for us, Woody? You know, and just, you know, just do a bit of that, and that'll make people laugh, because this film is actually inherently unfunny, given that it's supposed to be a comedy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you get Peter Sellers' fixation with Toulouse-Lautrec. What the hell is he about it? And it just turns up everywhere. And yeah, dressing up as Hitler and stuff like that. But Alan and Sellers had been together in the producer's previous film, What's the New Pussycat? Another one of these screwball comedies that you will never see on TV anymore because it is so of its time and basically unwatchable. And there, that has a crazy chase scene at the end where everybody jumps on go-karts.
Yeah.
And yes, it's hideously undercranked. This is the end scene of What's New Pussycat, which you get a tiny little glimpse of in Casino Royale.
There's a reference to it, isn't there?
They play the music in there. But it's done in that in very much Sellers gets his own. He only plays one character in it. This psychoanalyst and who is completely the craziest one in the whole film. Obviously, and you got Peter O'Toole in there being Peter O'Toole, but that's a good example of as I said, films that were just made for that specific point in time and forgotten. And unfortunately, Casino Royale has lived on
because of Bond. Yeah, because it makes it a curiosity.
Yeah,
and yeah, I mean, like it's not as though it's got an all-star cast, but that it wouldn't be the first all-star movie with an all-star cast to be forgotten by time because it's just rubbish.
Yeah,
and and I think that maybe what happens is that everyone, when they're not quite sure what to do with these screwball comedies, they go back to it's a mad world and try and see if they can hate that for a little while, just to see if they can get this film over the line and out through the door. And you feel that that's what this movie has done here. It's a movie that doesn't have an original thought in its head.
Yeah, well, because those films, when they are done well, they're brilliant. Mm. You've got like Cannonball Run, Blues Brothers, these films that, and so the genre went on. It's not as if it's only just from this, they only made these films from in the mid 60s. Mm. They didn't. They lasted for a long time and they were really good and people loved them because those films are good. This one is a hot mess. It is such a mess of a film. It is ridiculously bad in places. Of course, they've got a UFO landing in Trafalgar Square. Of course.
Oh, God, yeah.
Of course they have.
Just why?
But then you get other scenes. You get scenes like the scenes in Berlin are brilliant. I love them.
Yes, yeah.
I love
that. Actually, that Mata Bond sequence.
Yeah,
she's great, and I mean that actually worked quite nicely in the Ronnie Corbett little cameo.
Yeah,
was really nice. So that was that at that moment. I felt this film feels like it's actually being quite funny and is trying to say something as well. But it didn't last.
No.
Because her character almost changes completely when she moves on to the next scene.
Yeah.
She's still in the movie towards the end and her character has almost completely changed. I think her accent almost changes. It's really odd.
Graham, one thing that I actually found, even though it is a hot mess of a film, one thing I found really interesting watching it was that you could see that potentially Mike Myers and the Austin Powers producers almost certainly will have had a look at this. And there are bits that you can take as inspiration into there. You can draw quite a direct line from this film into the Austin Powers series, which, let's be fair, are far, far, far superior as a spy spoof and are done with no small amount of love. But I'd be amazed if they hadn't mined a little bit into here and picked out a few bits which they went, okay, there's a germ of something here that we can run with and do something a bit different and potentially build on. Because while it is a hot mess, there are occasionally bubblings of ideas where you could see where this film could go. And Austin Powers is one route that it could have easily gone into if they decided to go down that route.
Certainly. I watched Austin Powers last night, just as a remedy for watching Casino Royale. I'd watched Casino Royale. I'd watched probably about 3/4 hour of What's New Pussycat, and I thought, I'm going to watch Austin Powers because there's so much in this that was in Austin Powers. And even down to the fact that Austin Powers originally starts in 1967, the year when this film came out. And there is so many things in there, like the whole scene where with Sellers and Andrus on the rotating bed. The rotating bed is on Austin's 747, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And his jumbo jet. Yeah,
and the look of love as well. They play the look of love when although it's Susanna Hoff singing it in Austin Powers rather than Dusty Springfield's version. I wouldn't say that I love Susanna Hoff dearly, but yeah, you got to go with Dusty on this one.
Mm.
And so there's a huge amount there. Obviously, a lot is borrowed from those mid-60s Bond films. But yeah, they've obviously taken it. This brings Casino Royale into the Bond franchise. Really, it's a bridge between the two. And of course, it's well written. It's well written. It's directed by one person, and it's coherent all the way throughout. Even though it's largely a screwball comedy, but the thing is, the comic element is that the bad guys and Austin are ridiculous, but everyone else is playing it straight, aren't they? Effectively.
Yeah, I mean, it's Myers to an extent aping Sellers. In the kind of film that this could have been if Sellers had maybe a lot more role in this, if he'd done the multiple role things in the way that Mike Myers did, in the way that Sellers does in Doctor Strangelove, a year later, something like that?
Yeah, well, a couple of years before,
beg your pardon. I think that is what probably people might have been thinking about when Casino Royale was coming along, was maybe this was the kind of film that we were going to see. But obviously, you know, Stanley Kubrick is of a somewhat different level. But Myers aping Sellers... Yeah, and Andrus and Hurley on the bed in particular. The Fembots, I think, is a Casino Royale thing. Baccarat makes a cameo in Austin Powers. There's a clear link. Yeah. It is an undeserved legacy of Casino Royale. Casino does not deserve to have the legacy of Austin Powers, and yet it does. And I don't know whether or not the Austin Powers would have been as good if Casino Royale hadn't been there. So, if you are a student of the Austin Powers franchise, then you would have already seen this film because it would have led you to this movie, and you'll know where we're coming from. If you're curious about that, then it might be worth watching for that reason. But my goodness, you know, don't watch it. Just put it on and look at it. You know, just look at it.
Yeah. Casino Royale is the deadbeat dad of Austin Powers, isn't it?
Well, I mean, perhaps Michael Caine's character in Austin Powers in Goldmember is like a metaphor for actually Casino Royale. Wow.
Oh, my word.
Yeah.
That's a take. We've got there, haven't we?
We've gone deep. Very quickly, that escalated and did not see that coming at all. These other little bits, and again, yeah, I mean, whilst there is very, yeah, as Terry said, this does not deserve what it does. There's other bits and pieces where you just suddenly realize that, you know, who's been watching it and where. There's, again, maybe a complete coincidence, but for those of you who enjoy the Fast show, there is obviously a very, very lifted character there from the tailor who tails up Peter Sellers with the I was literally waiting for him to say, oh, suits you, sir. And again, that scene, whilst it has not necessarily aged well, again, Graham, that there is something that when Peter Sellers is walking through Q's laboratory, they've got that absolutely spot on. It's something that could have been, you know, it's spoofed well, but you could see almost part of that could have easily been lifted into a Roger Moore film with Moore walking through with Q. So there's bits that they can do well when they're actually put their mind to it. And that was one of them as well. I was like, oh, you've got the Q bit down to a bit of an art into there, because it is quite, I mean, which is naturally some of the funnier bits of the Bond franchise anyway, when you have Q and Bond bantering. But yes, that was another unexpected area that I was not expecting to come out of this film.
There's a gag in that scene. I agree with you, and I'd forgotten about that scene, which is foolish of me, because I thought it was excellent, that scene. And I just thought, yeah, the two tailors. So, like, you're saying, let's get a couple of Savile Row, forgive the contemporary, let's get a couple of Savile Row fags in and make them cue, and that worked. That totally worked. And it captured the moment, I think, as well. It captured that moment beautifully. But also, there's a gag in there that is actually used by in Octopussy, isn't it? the poison pen letter. Then they're rolling the eyes at the cheapness and the oldness of the gag. And then it's used in Octopussy because of the acid pen, I'm now thinking about that. I feel that would have been deliberate reference.
Yeah, obviously, because Octopussy came out at the same year as Never Say Never Again as well. The other
fake James Bond film. Yes. Much, much better James Bond film, it should be said.
Not much better. It kind of makes sense.
It hasn't aged well either as well, but it's not quite as loony. But I do appreciate that interpretation of Q's character. I thought it was genuinely satirical and quite clever. There's not much there. What do we think of David Niven? Because he does a lot of the heavy lifting in this film, which I suspect his character originally wasn't intended to be.
I don't think he was. I think he was bumped up a bit. He was called back to do a lot of scenes after Sellers walked out because there was some scenes to do. Interestingly, because I was watching a lot of other films other than the Casino Royale, I watched a film called Where the Spies Are, which was a film that came out a year before, which was directed, I think, by Val Guest, who was one of the directors on this film. It's got a couple of the other people in there. One of the tailors, who was Catweasel.
Catweasel, that guy, wasn't he?
He's in it briefly. John Le Mesurier's in it as well, and of course he's in it very, very briefly in Casino Royale. But that's a straight Bond ripoff, and David Niven is the lead character there, and it's played very much in a very sort of low rent, telling a Bond story set in Beirut. And he's caught up in a world of espionage, lots of gadgets, beautiful girls, and I watched that and thought, well, this is what a Bond film with David Niven in would have been like. Now, David Niven is pretty much the same age as Ian Fleming, was a good friend of Ian Fleming, I think, as well.
I think actually one of Fleming's original choices, Fleming was well known for not necessarily being particularly fond of having Connery cast, I've read quite a few places that David Niven was actually one of Fleming's main picks for Bond, which would have taken the franchise in a very different direction. Actually, I say that I thought he did a good job with what is some pretty ropey material in this film.
Yeah, certainly, certainly. But I think if you watch Where the Spies Are, good luck finding it. You get to see what a Niven Bond should have been like. And yes, he carries it off. He's just basically David Niven, really, just doing David Niven-y stuff. In this film, he drives around the Bentley. Very nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nice.
Only briefly saw the Bentley in From Russia With Love, didn't we? And even then it was stationary, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So
it was lovely to see the Bentley on screen. With what he has, it's
I thought that he did well to keep that movie coherent. Obviously having to come back and do some stuff. He was a reliable actor. A great classic character actor. Some of my favourite films have got David Niven in. For what it's worth, I think he would have been an outstanding James Bond, albeit a very, very different one. But I don't necessarily agree that he would have been sort of like foppish. I think he could have brought a bit of edge to it with the right direction.
Pink Panther. So Pink Panther, Niven and Sellers together. Mm. I think this is what would have been.
That's a magnificent film.
Yeah.
Niven things superbly in there and under right direction. He's been brilliant. One of my other favourite films, is The Guns of Navarone.
Yes.
And he was superb in that and genuinely intense. One of the most intensely dramatic film scenes in any film I've seen is in Guns of Navarone. And David Niven plays a key role in making that film work. He's not a lightweight actor. I think people tended to feel that maybe he was a bit of a lightweight actor, but he wasn't by any means. And he was a man who had a great deal of tragedy and trauma in his life. Mm. And I think he'd have brought a lot of that to his performances. But I think he tended to get cast in the kind of, oh, let's just like get an English gentleman.
Yeah. He did most of his later work in America, and then he was just typecast as English gentleman.
Yeah.
But when you see films like Guns of Navarone, and when he's on screen with Gregory Peck, and it wasn't one of his only time on screen with Gregory Peck, is it? And you can see that what a great actor
he's not out of his depth.
No, of course not. And he's bringing out the best in other actors as well.
Agreed. Yeah.
It's the Guns of Navarone, listeners. If you want to watch a film, look, watch that.
Yeah.
God's sake.
That is an amazingly good film. Yeah.
Watch that. Do not. Actually, Graham, there's one other set of films that started popping into my mind the longer I watched this. Because it does, you can always tell when a film is not going well when your mind is starting to wander off. Mine did a lot. But the set of films that started popping into my head, which and actually gave me a craving to watch, was the Naked Gun films. And I would have, and just again, I was thinking there were bits in there which I picked up, which I went, there are touches where you could see, again, there's bits of, you could have seen the manic energy of Leslie Nielsen quite easily put into a film like this. And actually, again, has been translated on screen as a kind of spy spoof. Again, a far superior one. In fact, to be honest, you can put, I could quite happily watch Leslie Nielsen films for a marathon in here. But again, you could kind of see what this could have been in another way. Again, one way was one route's Austin Powers. Another route is to go completely over the top, but just a gag a minute fire with which it sometimes felt like it was trying to get there. I would say if you're going to watch funny films, watch Naked Gun. Do not watch this one. You can definitely see where this film could have gone, and that would have been another route for it.
But unfortunately, there are so many places this film could have gone, and that's the problem with it. It loses it. It has, there is no control over this film, no control at all, and it is just left to its own devices in lots of respect. There is no creative control in this film, which is why it's such a mess. You're right saying about the Naked Gun, but when you think about those films, you think about the Naked Gun franchise, you think about Airplane and any Zucker Brother films, and those films are really tight. They're exceptionally tight. When Leslie Nielsen turns up to do a film, he really does turn up, and he puts everything in it. And everyone around him knows what they're doing, and everyone knows what the direction it's going in, and that's why they look like they're insane things, but they're not. They are so brutally tight, and all those films that we mentioned, we talked about earlier, things like Cannonball Run, Blues Brothers, all these things that look madcap and look out of control. It's all organized chaos, isn't it? This film is just chaos. It is, chaos. And if you like chaos, then maybe that's why you someone would like this film. But I think even then, it's
But a film is not a football match.
No,
a film is not an organic construct that you just like sort of like start and then see where it goes.
Yeah,
that the films, they have to be planned, meticulously planned, and the best films are meticulously planned.
Yeah,
and some of the people who've got the reputation for being the most freeform, most creative, most screwball are actually some of the most obsessive and organized people on the planet, and it shows, and you can see that. So the Zucker Brother films, who probably might have looked at the younger Zucker Brothers looking at that saying, yeah, you can make movies like that. We'll make them much, much better, and we'll make them with plots and scripts, you know, and we won't hire like ridiculously famous actors to do a good throw a hissy fit. And I think filmmakers might have learned an awful lot from Casino Royale.
Yeah.
In many ways, it is a filmmaker's film, but it is the lessons that you learn from it there, not necessarily about what it is. It was like how to make what should on paper have been a magnificent comedy.
Yeah.
Had all the right ingredients, great filmmakers, great actors in it, you know, lavish designs, tons and tons of money, and it's an absolute mess, and it just goes through. And so there's tons of results. I mean, I would hope that it's on the curriculum of any film studies, if you're going to learn how to make movies, watch this movie and go, bloody hell, how did they get this film so badly wrong when it could have been absolutely fantastic, and it could have taken the James Bond world into a completely different world. Yeah, look at that. £12 million in 1967.
Yeah, horrifically that over budget. Like, but insane. Hey, it made the money back.
Yeah.
Triple.
Yeah.
Because people thought they were going to see a proper Bond film.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they were curious, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, had the artwork as well is for the poster is very Bondy, and
I think
they did a very big advertising campaign with Twiggy as well, and it was a very, you know, it's a very cleverly marketed film, even though it was a pretty terrible film, all told. But Terry, like, I know that we are, you know, this is not a film which potentially deserves quite as much as we've given to it, but equally as well. I kind of feel that we've drawn out, not necessarily depths of the film, but we've drawn out depths of kind of film history. And I think that was your point. If you're going to watch this film, you're not going to get much out of it as a, you know, as a film for enjoyment or plot, but you are going to get a lot out of it if you're looking at it more from a kind of student of film perspective rather than just there for pure enjoyment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just as I said before, I mean, but watch this movie to see how not to make a movie like this. And if it did in fact inspire, you know, to an extent, movies like Airplane, for example, you know, and the Zucker Brothers films and indeed, the Leslie Nielsen films, the Spy Hard films as well, you know, then it has a fitting legacy. And of course, the direct link to Austin Powers. So I think maybe that's why ITV keep bringing it back. But I suspect it's the reason why it has that legacy, though. I don't know necessarily it's because of what it has done. I think it's because it is a James Bond film. And so people are attracted back to that brand and then are curious with it. And that's why it gets the kind of attention that the movie probably doesn't actually deserve, but then in turn acts as a cautionary tale, if you like.
Yeah.
On how not to do things, how to ruin a perfectly good setup. And there are people who I think watch it and just like it for what it is. And, you know, yeah, we talked about the Berlin sequence. Any moment where Ursula Andress is in that, she lights up the film.
Yeah.
She's amazing in the film and she lights it up, and it's a much better movie when she's in it than when she's not in it. So it does have these moments to enjoy, but it is, it's a film to be studied or just to look at.
Yes.
Rather than a film to be watched or appreciated.
Yeah.
Yes. It's a strain. It has certain merits and interest, which plot and coherence is certainly not one of them. But Graham, I think probably one thing that the Casino Royale 1967 did do and foreshadowed in the rest of the Bond franchise, and almost is one of the sort of first, not quite the first motifs, but is one of the recurring motifs of a Bond franchise. Is our old friend rights battles. This is essentially the one of the OGs of the rights battles for Bond, and foreshadows, probably ties it neatly back to what we were talking about with Amazon at the very end, to tie a little bit of a bow on this podcast.
Yeah. I mean, that's the reason why it got made. It got made because Broccoli and Saltzman couldn't get the rights to it. They were owned by a guy called Charlie Feldman, who was a filmmaker in Hollywood, and who was actually originally the boss, I think, of Saltzman and Broccoli.
Mm.
And I think one of the writers of this, Wolf Mankiewicz, was the guy who introduced Broccoli to Saltzman. So
right.
there's lots to tie in with the franchise. But Feldman was going to make a serious Bond film. He was going to make a serious version of Casino Royale. He was also going to make one with Saltzman and Broccoli. That was on the table. Richard Maybaum wrote a script for it, even. That's been lost to the ether. So, but many scripts were drawn up by various people. And but it never materialized. And I think what happened was they got into this problem over Thunderball, which was the other book they didn't own, and the mess of Thunderball and trying to get that together, and they didn't want to go through it again. And Feldman was asking far too much. He wanted, I think, 75% of the profits, and Eon said, "Nah, we won't. It's not worth our while. Already gone through Thunderball, and that's mixed things up too much. We've already got Sean Connery threatening to leave now, I think Feldman even offered Sean Connery $1 million to be in it. He didn't offer him that. No. Connery said, "I'll be in it for $1 million," and Feldman laughed him out and said, "Look, there's no way we're going to spend that much money on you." They ended up overspending on the film by more than $1 million, and apparently he regretted not getting Connery in and playing it straight. But I think because there was such a big falling out between Feldman and Broccoli and Saltzman, that he went full at it to just try and make a joke of the whole franchise. And I don't know if that worked, because I think at the end of it, the franchise survived, although it wasn't as big. The Bond mania was on the wane even then, and especially when Connery started phoning in his performances.
Lazenby famously was advised that Bond was out and that he shouldn't bother. And obviously that was completely wrong. But yeah, I mean, if it was an attempt to derail the Bond franchise, it didn't succeed, obviously. Because we are still talking about it now. It's an interesting take that.
But tragically as well, Feldman died within a year of the film being made. And that a lot of people say that it hastened his ill health. The stress of putting it together and the falling out with Peter Sellers. It's a bit of a curse on this film, because I think most people who touched it, I think one of the original scriptwriters died. The guy who originally bought the rights off Ian Fleming, he died too. A little bit of a curse running through this
film. Angela Schuyler's in this film as well, on Her Majesty's Secret Service.
There's plenty of them.
She sadly passed away prematurely.
The thing that you can do with this film, if you really want to, is to spot the actors who have also appeared in the Bond franchise at some point, which is a fun drinking game, if you will. But I'm going to wrap this up, because I think hopefully, I don't think there's too much more to say on it, and hopefully people, if you're going to look at it on the merits of it, which is a curio rather than anything else. But I'm going to leave, I'm going to ask this to Terry, because I feel this is a tough question, and I'm a tough questioner. Terry, if you were sat in a room and told that you were only ever allowed to watch one more Bond film, and it would either be Casino Royale or Die Another Day, what would you choose?
This is a kind of Roger Moore and Sean Connery in a fight. Who wins? Who wins? It's a tough question, Alan. it's Die Another Day. It's not even it's actually not a tough question at all. Die Another Day over Casino Royale for me, absolutely.
I
quite like Die Another Day, even though it's really, really bad.
Because
I like the first half of Die Another Day. It's really, really enjoyable, and it gets a bit silly afterwards. Well, it gets very
silly afterwards. You have to watch the whole of Die Another Day.
And you're going to be there with me, are you?
In a row.
Yeah. Can I just say that I'll pass on both of them, actually. That's it.
If it was gun to the head, Casino Royale, Die Another Day, choose.
How are we in this situation?
I don't know.
What sort of pathway did we go down?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the tough questioner over there, he knows.
What sort of hideous totalitarian state are we living in?
No, it's just a question of our times, Graham. It's a reflection of our times. You have a choice. Let's turn it into we should make Casino Royale and Die Another Day a kind of like wedge point in the culture war. It's our contribution to the culture war. It's a pretty crap contribution, well, Graham, if truth be known.
As Terry said, gun to your head, which one do you choose?
Yeah, I choose death. I choose death, Gary. I don't want to live in this world.
And the curse of Casino Royale continues. We have lost another good man. yes, we could certainly start a poll as well. But I know that there's also some strange people on the internet. There are some. I'm sure I've bumped into a few Die Another Day stands somewhere.
Definitely. Which, well, there's that guy who
baffles
wrote a whole
me
book
as
about
much
it.
As it would do anybody on this at all on Casino Royale. But I think that's brought us into a dystopia that none of us really want to be in at all. So I think it's a good time to wrap this podcast up. It's been nice to talk about news. It's also, whilst I wouldn't say I enjoyed the film, it's been quite enjoyable to talk about a film which I didn't really know that much about. I have watched at some point and it completely gone out of my head. So we will be back with more Odd Job Pod. But for now, Graham, your parting thoughts on Casino Royale, other than just don't watch it?
Oh, that was my parting thought.
Mm. Oh, okay. Excellent. Terry, any advance on don't watch it?
No, study it, yeah, and put it on in the background. But don't watch it, for goodness sake.
No, just don't watch it. This is a comedy spoof landfill rather than action movie landfill. It's not even action. There's minimal
action. I'm worried that we've intrigued people about it now, though. People who've never seen it, or people who've seen it years ago and thinking, oh, maybe I want to put myself through that. And yeah, fine. It's like people who see people like eating a spoonful of cinnamon and thinking, yeah, I'm going to do that at home, even though it looks horrific.
Yeah. Well, don't disabuse yourselves of that, listeners. You're good. If you're tempted to watch just put something that you like on instead. There's so much new stuff out there, sit down and watch Black Doves or something like that.
Sit down and watch The Guns of Neverone. That's a much better thing to do.
Possibly the takeaway from this podcast.
Yes.
Sadly, The Guns of Neverone falls outside of landfill. And even if it didn't, you wouldn't find it anywhere near landfill, would you? Because it's a magnificent piece of work.
But if you want to watch Sellers and Niven together, then watch Pink Panther.
Yes.
Yes.
Those are the two films to watch. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's plenty of good films. Hopefully what you've come away with, dear listener, is that there are plenty of good films that you can watch that aren't this film. And hopefully we've reminded you of a few of those, from Doctor Strangelove to Pink Panther to Naked Gun to Cannonball Run. There's plenty that you can watch which you will get far, far, far much more enjoyment out of than this. But hopefully this podcast is enjoyable. Imagine if we'd done a director's commentary of this one. That would be... We'd have had quite a few drinks.
I don't think we'd have made it.
Quite a few drinks.
We'd have had to have abandoned it.
It would be something. We'll be back with more Odd Job Pod into slightly more serious matters. And then there's also the small matter of the action movie Landfill, which is the kind of spin-off of the Odd Job Pod. The next film that we'll be doing on that is Broken Arrow, which is also slightly over the top and insane, but in a much better way, I would say. Until then, it just remains for me to say thank you for tuning in. Don't watch Casino Royale. I've been Gary Andrews. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.